Dr. David Ray Griffin is professor of philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology and professor of religion at the School of Religion, Claremont Graduate University. He is executive director of the Center for Process Studies. He is editor of the Constructive Postmodern Thought series published by the State University of New York Press. His recent books are titled Unsnarling the World Knot, Consciousness, Freedom, and the Mind-Body Problem, Religion and Scientific Naturalism, and Reenchantment Without Supernaturalism, A Process Philosophy of Religion. Dr. Griffin will speak to us until about 5 o'clock, and then we'll take a break for refreshments outside on the patio, and then we'll return for questions and answers. So will you join me in welcoming Dr. David Ray Griffin, speaking on process theology and introduction.
Thanks, John. Thank all of you for coming out. So I understand this is working, so you can all hear me. Okay, good. This is an introduction to process theology. That term can be understood in a broad sense or a narrow sense. In the very broad sense of the term, process theology runs back to the time of Hegel and Schelling and runs through Bergson and up to Whitehead and Hartshorne. Phil Clayton, whom we have just hired at the school, represents process theology in that broad sense. I will be speaking here of process theology in the more narrow sense that is based on the thought of Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne as the two leading philosophers of this movement. And a further delimitation, I will also be talking about my own version of process theology that isn't necessarily identical with even that of everybody, all the other process theologians in Claremont. It's, of course, always problematic to talk about one's own theology, particularly remembering the old adage, one person's theology is another person's belly laugh. Maybe I will give you a couple today. What I'm going to do is, rather than simply giving an introduction to the basic concepts, which we've done 1,000 times, and you can find, for example, in the book that John Cobb and I wrote a long time ago, Process Theology, An Introductory Exposition, I'm just going to list a number of problems that you might have, one or more of, that you've worried about, and how process theology can help deal with these. This is how I myself got hooked on it. I had some theological problems when I came here. I had some other problems too, but we won't go. But the theological, and I started seeing how Whiteheadian thought could help me solve those problems and reconcile things that I couldn't see how to bring together. This will, of course, be very superficial because I'm going to try to list 6 or 7 of these in the hour that I have. But just to give you those of you who don't know process theology, to give you a brief indication of something it might do for you, I will list 3 kinds of problems. The first will be philosophical theology or philosophy of religion type problems. The second will be those distinctive to Christian theology. And then some third category, some ethical issues. So under the first, under philosophical theology, generally the problem of evil is considered the classic philosophy of religion problem. It arises from a particular notion of God as being that there is a divine reality we call God, who is perfectly good and also perfect in power, generally understood to mean all-powerful or omnipotent. then, as that's normally understood, the question arises, well, then why should there be any evil? Because if God is all good, God would presumably want to avoid all evil, that is, all genuine evil, not just this little shadow side that makes the brightness more beautiful, but genuine evil. God would presumably want to avoid that. And if God is all-powerful, God presumably would be able to do it. Therefore, the old question is, why is there evil? And particularly, why is there so much just really horrendous evil, to use the title of Marilyn Adams' new book? Well, part of the answer to this is the way the doctrine of divine power got worked out. The doctrine that we call the classical view of omnipotence, which means that God can unilaterally, single-handedly bring about events in the world. So that any event that you think of as a horrendous evil, God could have simply prevented it. This doctrine was made so intense, the implications of omnipotence, by the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, which was developed at the end of the second Christian century. Many of us had been taught that the idea that the world was created out of nothing was a biblical doctrine, but it turns out that it isn't. So you have a Hebrew scholar at Harvard University recently writing a book called The Creation and the Persistence of Evil, in which he argues that you don't find this doctrine in Genesis or anywhere else in what we Christians call the Old Testament. But the assumption had been that you do find it in the intertestamental literature, particularly in 2 Maccabees. And therefore, the assumption was that the New Testament could presuppose it. So there are about five passages in the New Testament that, if you want to read them as suggesting creation ex nihilo, you can read them that way, and they have traditionally been read that way on the assumption that these Christian authors were presupposing this development in 2 Maccabees. But now you have a German theologian, Gerhard May, M-A-Y, who's written a book called Creatio Ex Nihilo, and he argues that no, the doctrine is not there in 2 Maccabees. It is not in the New Testament, and it did not appear until the very end of the second Christian century. So you had almost two full centuries of Christian thought in which Christian theologians presupposed Plato's view, that this world was created out of a chaos. And as Plato said, this meant God made things as good as possible. But that meant that it wasn't just God unilaterally determining what would happen. So there was this idea that there was some resistance in the creation. But once the doctrine of creatio ex nihilo was developed, that meant there was no possibility of resistance, because the very matter that this world was created out of was itself created by God, and so God had absolute power over it. So it was out of that that the problem of evil became such a difficult problem for Christian theologians and all Christian peoples, and then it spread also to Judaism and Islam, so it has been a problem, severe problem, for all the Abrahamic traditions. The problem became even worse with the Enlightenment, because with the Enlightenment there was the commitment to begin basing our beliefs on things that could be justified in terms of reason and experience. So the solution to the problem of evil had always been, finally, faith. We can only trust that God has some reason for allowing these horrendous evils. And they would even appeal to paradox, and some less kind thinkers would say, well, a paradox is just a nice word for contradiction. And when you read some of the theologians, you do see things that do look like contradictions. But that was okay, because religion was based on faith. But once the thinker said, well, now we're going to base things on what is rationally credible, the problem of evil became much more serious. And so at least one of the major reasons for the widespread nature of atheism in the West, particularly among the intelligentsia, has been the problem of evil. Process theology rejects creation ex nihilo and returns to the biblical and Platonic view that this world was created out of chaos. And it's a chaos of events, each event having some degree of capacity for self-determination. Now, in the 19th century, that idea would have seemed incredible, given the understanding of matter that was held there. But now with quantum physics and the notion of indeterminacy, the idea that there might be some small element of self-determinacy in electrons and protons and in the smaller quanta making them up is not so counterintuitive. This means, as Whitehead developed his thought there, that divine power is to be understood not as coercive power, not as controlling power, but as persuasive power. And so God cannot unilaterally determine what happens in the world. What happens in the world is a joint product between the divine persuasion and then the creaturely response. Furthermore, that's the first part of process theology's answer. Why is there some evil in the world? Because the world is self-determining. And so even though God is perfectly good and perfect in power, perfect power is persuasive power, not coercive power. So it's not contradictory, the fact that there is some evil. But then you still might ask, well, why so much evil? Does self-determination require that we have the kinds of evils that we've suffered throughout the 20th century? We associate terms such as the Holocaust and other symbols such as Hiroshima of terrible evil. Why so much evil? Well, another dimension of process thought is what I call the variables of power and value. That is, by hypothesis, what God is trying to do in the world is bring about creatures who can experience higher and higher forms of value. So we normally think in these terms, that we think human beings probably enjoy kinds of value that our dogs can't. And likewise, our dogs can probably enjoy forms of value that the fleas on them can't, and so on down. So we think in terms of, so that the picture of the evolutionary process as a process through which God has brought about higher means of value can make intuitive sense to us. The suggestion from process theology, then, is that as God brought forth such creatures, God therefore also necessarily brought creatures forth with greater power. That also fits with our experience. We have forms of power that our dogs do not. No dog can have the symbolic power to create nuclear weapons. Dogs have powers that their fleas do not, and so on. And so it looks like there's a correlation between the degree of value, intrinsic value, the value of experience that can be enjoyed, and the degree of power. Well, power, of course, is a very ambiguous thing. Can be good, used for good, and can also be used for evil. We can use it to make ourselves miserable. Far more human beings commit suicide than dogs. We can make ourselves far more miserable than the dogs, even with their fleas. Likewise, we can make each other far more miserable. You know, chimpanzees fight each other, but they don't stage wars. They don't build up symbol systems and armaments dedicated to killing each other. So we can be much more destructive with our power than any other creatures. So the suggestion of process theology is, well, the question is, you know, was God justified in bringing forth creatures such as us? And some people, deep ecologists, have suggested the world would really be better off without us. Well, better off in what sense, though? Yes, if you're thinking strictly from an ecological point of view and the long-term survival. But by hypothesis, God was interested in bringing forth creatures with the highest possible degree of intrinsic value. But this was a risk. So the justification, theodicy being the word for dealing with the problem of evil, coming from the word decay, so justifying the ways of God. Process theology's justification for God bringing us forth was this, that there it was not a choice of bringing forth us or other creatures just like us who wouldn't be so dangerous. No, the choice was bringing forth creatures like us with all of our dangers to ourselves and to the other creatures, or not bringing forth creatures like us at all. So this, I suggest, just a hint here, and of course I've written a lot of pages on this topic, brings forth a reconciliation of two doctrines. On the one hand, atheism. The atheists are right insofar as they're rejecting traditional theism. Yes, we say, if that's what you mean by God, that God does not exist. If that's what you mean by God, God does not exist. But if by the word God you mean a creator of our universe who created it out of love and compassion and has a sense of justice and wants us to work and relate to each other with justice, yes, there is a God. So this is process theology's way of reconciling theism and atheism. We would agree with Stendhal, given what he means by God, the traditional view of God. Stendhal famously said, God's only excuse is that he doesn't exist. We agree, yes, he does not exist, that God. A second traditional problem of philosophy of religion is the problem of science and religion. I would say this probably comes second or third, at least in the top three, of the other major reasons for theism and the general loss of interest in religion and its place in the public world, in the modern world. The contrast, the tension between religion and scientific naturalism. In the 18th and 19th century, there was a rise of the movement that's now called scientific naturalism. And what this meant most basically is that there are no supernatural interruptions of the world's normal system of cause and effect. This started becoming a major factor in the 18th century deists. So in the 17th century, with Boyle and Newton, what we think of as the rise of modern science, it was still a highly supernaturalistic worldview. In fact, they developed many of their doctrines, their mechanistic theory of nature and their sensationist view of perception, in order to support a supernaturalist worldview. So what many of us were taught was that modern science was the rise of modern atheism is the opposite of the truth. These guys were seeking to support a very supernaturalistic worldview. That was late in the 17th century, but already early in the 18th century, many were starting to say, well, no, we don't believe in these supernatural interruptions. So you had the rise of the deist movement. And then in the early 19th century with Schleiermacher tries to work out a system in which there would be no supernatural interruptions. Then David Friedrich Strauss believes that Schleiermacher made one exception in his Christology and allowed for supernatural intervention. And so Strauss, with his famous program to demythologize the scripture or give a mythological interpretation, insists on a completely rigorous exclusion of any supernatural interruptions. Well, by the middle of the 19th century, there was a full-blown movement for scientific naturalism. Charles Darwin was a central member of that movement. So in the English-speaking world, you can say it's about the middle of the 19th century when scientific naturalism wins the battle for the control of the scientific worldview. Much of what we call liberal theology has been an attempt, as I've indicated by listing these names, to work out a system of Christian theology that would not appeal to supernatural interruptions. So you see what this means. It would mean, first of all, no appeals to miracles to prove that Christianity is the one true religion. It would mean with your Christology that Jesus would not be God, and so on. So working through all the doctrines that way to eliminate the supernaturalism. So the major division in modern theology is roughly all over this issue. So what we generally call conservative to fundamentalist theologies have retained the supernaturalistic worldview and still appeal to miracles and have a supernaturalistic Christology and soteriology and so on. Whereas the liberal theologies have at least more or less consistently rejected supernaturalism. Now, you might assume, well, this has led then to a reconciliation between Christian faith and scientific naturalism. But this brings us to another dimension of what is normally called scientific naturalism. Besides excluding supernaturalist interruptions, the movement known as supernaturalism affirms many more doctrines that are much more restrictive of the possibility of a religious worldview. I've come to call this doctrine Naturalism SAM, S-A-M, with the S standing for sensationism, or the sensationist theory of perception, the A standing for atheism, and the M standing for materialism. Now the S, the SAM, the sensationist theory of perception, means you can only perceive things through your physical sense organs. And that means you can only perceive those things that excite those organs. That means if something is non-physical, in what we normally mean by non-physical, you can't perceive it. You can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't hear it. Well, God or Brahman or whatever we have used to refer to the divine reality is not a being that excites our sense organs. That means religious experience is not possible. The atheism, means there is no divine reality to experience. There is no divine reality who created our world. And then materialism means, among other things, that there's no distinction between the mind and the brain. Normally we've thought of the soul or the mind or the psyche as a non-physical reality that was closely related to our brains, but not strictly identical with them. And so we've thought in terms of the immortality of the soul, life after death. But according to materialism, there can be no distinction. The word mind or soul is just another word for the brain. So there's nothing in your head, as some philosophers put it, but your physical brain. And that means, of course, when your body dies, you die, because you are nothing but your body. So that obviously rules out any kind of life after death. It also rules out freedom. So materialism, as it has developed, is a very restrictive doctrine in terms of allowing for a worldview that you could call moral and ethical. So modern liberal theology has also, for the most part, tried not to contradict that doctrine. Well, this has led much of modern liberal theology to become more and more vacuous. So you still have theologians making assertions and using the old language quite often. But then when you probe and you say, okay, come on, now what does that really mean? You find out it doesn't mean much of anything. And so there's only a verbal difference between the ordinary atheistic, reductionistic worldview and then this kind of liberal, modern liberal Christian theology. Process theology responds to this movement by developing a new form of naturalism. So it affirms the first meaning of naturalism that I gave you, which I called naturalism in S, which just means non-supernaturalism. But it rejects naturalism Sam in favor of a doctrine that I have called 3P naturalism, or naturalism followed by 3Ps. And the 3Ps stand for a prehensive doctrine of perception, a pan-entheistic view of the universe, and a pan-experientialist view of the world. Now, what does that do for us, other than make it hard to speak? The prehensive doctrine of perception says that sensory perception is a secondary, very high-level form of perception based on a more fundamental mode of perception of prehending. You know the word prehensile, so it's not a strange word, that we grasp other things in a pre-sensory way, a more fundamental mode of perception, which is non-sensory. We perceive, assuming a distinction between the mind and the brain, I would say I, in the sense of my mind, I prehend my own brain. But likewise, then, I can directly prehend other souls. Many of you are aware of the evidence for telepathy, that there seems to be some sort of direct soul-to-soul relation, where we feel at a distance, the literal meaning of telepathy. But that would mean then also there would be no reason why we couldn't talk about a direct experience of God that would be analogous to telepathy. And so this opens the way again to taking religious experience and moral experience seriously. Panentheism is the doctrine that our world exists in God, that all things exist in God. So it's different from pantheism, which simply says our world is God. Panentheism distinguishes between God and the world, says God is the soul of the world and in whom we live, move, and have our being. Now, panentheism was already implicit in what I said earlier about the rejection of creation ex nihilo, that God is always in relation to a world, if by a world we mean a multiplicity of finite beings, which may be in a chaotic state. Now, sometimes by world we mean one that has been brought into an ordered state, a cosmos. But in the more general sense, God exists naturally in relation to a world, and this world takes different shapes in different cosmic epochs. So panentheism is the other side of the rejection of creation ex nihilo, that God always God has created our world out of pre-existing things that pre-existed our world, not that pre-existed God. Finally, then, this doctrine says there is a divine reality for us to experience. Experientialism says that experience, like the lady's turtles, goes all the way down. Now, initially, this doctrine seems counterintuitive to us. When I first encountered it, I thought it was absolutely absurd. But now that I've become more intimate with it, I see it's just self-evidently true. Partly, think of it this way. William James had already made this argument. If we have a naturalistic universe, now James believed in God, but not a God who intervenes supernaturally, how could creatures such as us, with our experience and our spontaneity, arise out of matter understood to be completely devoid of all spontaneity or self-motion and completely devoid of all experience? How could something how could experience arise out of non-experiencing things? Now, there are many materialist philosophers who've come around to this point of view and said, well, actually, we cannot figure out any way that can happen. So Colin McGinn, whom we had here on our campus a few years ago, said it's just an ultimate mystery we have to live with. So he was starting to sound like a traditional theologian. I mean, materialism was his religion, but he said they're just things we can't explain and we just got to learn to live with that. Why should we be able to answer all these questions? And several other materialists now have come along and say, you know, you're right. If you want an argument for a supernaturalistic God, this would actually be a very good one, because only a supernatural God could bring creatures such as us, or, you know, animal life in general, out of insentient matter. So if you've got a non-supernaturalistic worldview, pan-experientialism, the idea that there have always been experiencing beings, not conscious beings, but with a very minimal kind of experience, that is part and parcel of the doctrine. Now, this does another thing for Christian theology or theistic religion altogether. One of the major problems of the modern world, once they developed this mechanistic view of matter, was how in the world could God be related to this world? You, in a sense, had the mind-body problem writ large. The mind-body problem being, how could a non-physical soul relate to this physical mechanistic body? Well, likewise with the universe, how could God relate to this mechanistic universe? So that was part of the basis for this move to deism and then the complete dissociation of God from the natural world that has been part and parcel of our ecological crisis, and the fact that the churches have been so poorly equipped to deal with this, because we've had a theological tradition for almost two centuries that had dissociated God from the what we call the natural world. Now, I see I was optimistic to think I was going to get to seven of my points. I was going to do each of these in seven. Didn't come close. Let me just mention a couple more points under the science and religion and move on. One of the major problems with modern materialism has been to try to work out a intelligible doctrine of evolution. This is the orthodox doctrine. It's called neo-Darwinism. It's an attempt to work out a completely atheistic view of how the evolutionary process occurred. Well, as you know, there have been enormous debates between the evolutionists and the creationists. And the creationists have argued that the neo-Darwinian evolutionists do not have a good story. Well, actually, they're right. They do not have a very good story. They've got the timeline right, evidently. It does seem like all the evidence seems to suggest that the universe is somewhere between 12 and 16 billion years old. And several creationists now are agreeing to this. They will call their view progressive creationism. But they still want to insist that you need supernatural interventions to bring about the development of new species. Process theology allows you to have a middle position on this that disagrees both with the creationist and with the neo-Darwinian evolutionists. So process theology is evolutionary. It's a theistic evolutionism. But it holds that divine persuasion is necessary at each stage of the process, and that it is inconceivable that the new species could have emerged, particularly given how suddenly, in terms of evolutionary time, they have emerged, if it were all purely accidental. So let me just mention that as something that we think we can give a good answer to. If you're interested in this, look in the final chapter of my book called Religion and Scientific Naturalism. It's the longest chapter in the book, and in a sense, the chapter all the rest of them are leading up to. within science, process theology has an addition too. Some of you, I know, are interested in parapsychology or psychical research. Well, given naturalism, Sam, that just cannot occur by definition. There cannot be telepathic experience, and there certainly cannot be psychokinesis. Process theology, with its different form of naturalism, suggests that, yes, those events, as strange as they seem to us, can occur. And Whitehead's philosophy provides a basis for that. Again, those of you who are interested in that, I won't say anything more, but I did write a book called Parapsychology, Philosophy, and Spirituality, in which I lay out a number of the kinds of empirical evidence for these strange things and also give some indication how this worldview can allow for that. I mention that here because I believe, as did William James, that parapsychology is very important for theology. James once said, "Once let empiricism be wedded to religion, and maybe we will be in for a new burst of religion." And I think that's true, and I'm trying to promote that movement. Let me move to Christian theology proper, and here I will have to move along very quickly. One of the major topics where modern liberal theology has been perceived as being so unsatisfactory is the question of eschatology, in the sense of what does it all come to? And with regard in particular to individual eschatology, I'm also interested in social eschatology, bringing in the reign of God on earth, but I do not have time to talk about that today. So let me talk just about this. I've already mentioned that with our distinction between the mind and the soul, we again open the way to the possibility, at least, of thinking in terms of life after death. Now, sometimes this idea has been criticized, the notion of immortality of the soul. It said, well, that's a Greek idea, and the biblical idea is really resurrection of the body. And that's a better image because it shows the mind-body unity that the Bible had. And this idea that the mind and the soul are distinct, well, that's Greek dualism, and that's bad, and we ought to get rid of that. The problem with all that argument has been that it's been a rather sophisticated way of doing what I said earlier, using the traditional language, but then when you ask what was underneath, there wasn't very much. And so when you read these modern liberal theologians, even some of them called neo-Orthodox theologians, you find that there was no real doctrine there of ongoing life. And this relates back to the problem of evil, because there are many aspects of the problem of evil that can be solved apart from belief in an afterlife. But there are other aspects that are very difficult. The fact that so many people get such a raw deal in this life, so many people really don't have a chance because of just circumstances of birth or just some freak accident. And one can at least work out a much more satisfactory theodicy if one has this dimension in it. The language we have used, and I believe John Cobb was the first to use this, is the resurrection of the soul. And it really combines these two images. The resurrection of the body did suggest a very supernaturalistic view of how God would be related to bringing you into a new stage of existence. Resurrection of the soul, by contrast, suggests that the soul does have some inherent capacity so that it doesn't take a miracle to keep you going. It doesn't take a violation of the way that God normally relates to the world. But the term resurrection, as opposed to immortality, suggests that there is divine initiative there. And that was what was objectionable to many theologians about the language of immortality. It sounded like, oh, well, this is just an inherent quality of the soul, and divine grace has nothing to do with it. Well, divine grace does have a lot to do with it in two stages. First of all, it was divine grace that brought us through this something like 4 billion year evolutionary process on this earth, which we got to the point where we perhaps have the capacity to survive apart from the bodies that were, by hypothesis, needed to bring us into existence. Likewise, this new stage of existence, even though in some respects we can say it's a continuation, it's a radically new environment if we find ourselves in this. And this would take, from our point of view anyway, fresh new divine input into this process. So in those two respects, you have divine grace involved in that. And so this image of resurrection of the soul conveys that twofold point. Next point I will cover even more quickly, Christology. As I suggested earlier, the traditional Christology was fully supernaturalistic. Jesus was simply God, or at least God was related to and incarnate in Jesus in a way that was absolutely different in kind from the way that God was related, say, to the prophets and to the rest of us. In modern liberal theology, however, in rejecting this idea, the theologians have not provided us a basis for, okay, so that old stuff is mythology. And I'm using the language here of John Hick, who used to teach at the graduate school here. He's written a book called The Myth of God Incarnate. If we accept that's mythological, okay. But then what's the basis now for paying any special attention to Jesus? Was God related to Jesus in some special way? And then by extension, one can ask that question about the Bible in general. If we give up supernaturalism, is there any sense in still continuing to focus our worship life around this book? If God was not related to it in some special way, why assume there's any special wisdom in that that would relate us to our Creator? So process theism, again, says both and. That on the one hand, naturalism is true. It's a theistic naturalism, of course, but it says that in one sense, God is related to every event in the same way. The slogan that some theologians use is God acts in the same way always and everywhere. So there you have the naturalism. But in another sense, process theology points out we can talk about variable divine action in the world. And this has been one of the most difficult problems for modern theology, to talk about variable divine action, differentiated, so that some acts may be acts of God in a special way, and so that some events may really be revelatory of God, not just because, as Tillich says, they evoked a revelatory response in us, because there was something inherent in those events that especially embodied the divine character and purpose. So it was appropriate for those to be taken as revelatory events. So, again, I'm just giving you a hint of things that process theology can help you with if you're interested with them, that if you are a Christian, process theology can give you a basis for affirming that on the one hand, Jesus is fully human. Fully human, as Chalcedon said, but also that God is present in Jesus in a special way, so that it's appropriate to take him. Those of you who are not Christian can do an analogous thing with the prophets or those that you yourself have thought to embody special divine revelation. That point leads up to religious pluralism. I have 3 minutes to deal with that. John, wish me luck. Well, actually, this topic is very central to it, because at the crux of the difference between absolutists and pluralists has been the issue of Christology. That is, from the point of view of Christian theology, that the supernaturalists have considered Christianity to be the one true religion because it was the one religion that was founded by God in person. Religious pluralists are ones who affirm that even if we are Christians, we see other religions as equally legitimate. They have an equal right to exist in God's world. And that they themselves can also be the source of saving truths and values. So that's essentially what pluralism is in the generic sense. But as pluralism has worked itself out, it has led to relativism. That is, the dominant move in pluralism has led to a position that has made it difficult to see that anything was true. That is, in the interest of affirming that one religion was not superior to others, that ours was not the only one that was true, pluralists have often ended up saying they're all wrong. And that doesn't satisfy anybody. Process theology, and John Cobb has led the way in this, has made a distinction between two fundamentally different kinds of religion. Three, actually, but since I'm out of time anyway, I'll limit it to two. The basic problem that has led to this relativistic conclusion is the assumption that there must be only one ultimate reality. And therefore, what Buddhists mean by emptiness or nirvana or the Buddha nature must be identical to what Christians mean by God, or what Jews and Muslims or theistic Hindus mean by God. On that assumption, if you're assuming that what the mystics of these non-theistic traditions tell you is true, and you try to reconcile that with what Christian theistic mystics have told you is true, what they have in common is not very much. And so you have to eliminate everything distinctive in the Judaic Christian Muslim tradition that provides the basis for social justice and the best parts of our tradition in order to make it seem like we're all referring to the same divine reality. Process theology, building on Whitehead's distinction between God and creativity, suggests maybe there are two ultimate realities, and that the theistic religions have been oriented around one ultimate reality, which we call God, and who is a personal being who is informed by the concern for justice in the world, whereas the other traditions are oriented around this reality that Whitehead calls creativity, which is the formless ultimate reality. And Whitehead's descriptions are very similar to some Buddhist descriptions of codependent origination or emptiness, and some Vedantist description of Nirguna Brahman, Brahman without qualities, and the description of the Tao without qualities. And so the suggestion is that at least there are two fundamentally different kinds of religion in the world, and that we don't have to say that they're both saying the same thing in order to say that they're both true. Maybe they're both equally true. Maybe they both have equally valid insights that are of saving importance. And that maybe Christians could be enriched by learning from these other traditions, and maybe they could be enriched by learning from the theistic traditions. So it sets out a very different, and we think much more helpful, form of religious pluralism. In fact, we're so convinced that it's much more helpful that this spring we're going to have a conference called Toward a Genuine Religious Pluralism that will be held on this campus. And it'll be in honor of our Marjorie Suhaki, who has retired this last year and whose passion now is religious pluralism. Well, I'm out of time, so what I would have talked about is various questions of ethics, how we reconcile self-interest and altruism, how this is a form of ethics that feminists have found very interesting and appealing, and they've been quite often the leaders in developing this. And then ecological ethics, which many people have come to Whitehead because Whiteheadian process theology has provided a basis for an ecological ethic that they couldn't find anywhere else. Well, thank you very much for your patience and your attention.
Thank you, David. Perhaps during the question and answer period, someone will ask a question about ecological ethics or altruism and self-interest. We have some refreshments outside. I'll come and start ringing the bell in about 10 minutes. That'll give everybody a chance to get through the line, but we need to come back for about 45 minutes.
My notes. Well, the on the question of ethics, one of the major problems has been the assumption that we are self-enclosed individuals. The most famous recent proponent of this is what was her name? Atlas Shrugged. Is it Ayn or Ann? Ann Ayn Rand, and you know this movement has quite a following, and it's the assumption is that anything other than ethical egoism is simply impossible. And I haven't read her rigorously, but in talking to people who are devotees of the movement, it sounds like it's metaphysically impossible. Anyway, one reason for this arises from this notion that we are enduring substances. This was Descartes' language. The language of substance is a traditional term for that which is most fully real. And there's nothing wrong with substance language, but it has taken on this connotation of an enduring thing that's strictly self-identical through time. Well, as Charles Hartshorn pointed out, if you are strictly identical with your past and future selves, and therefore you're strictly non-identical with other people, then your relation to your own future is different in kind from your relation to the future of others. And therefore, the injunction that we get from the book of Leviticus, repeated by Jesus, love your neighbor as yourself, is metaphysically impossible. You could not love your neighbor as you love yourself because the two are strictly non-identical. So process theology has an event notion of individuality that is somewhat like the Buddhist notion that reality is made up of momentary events. And so when the Buddhists say there is no soul, they meant most fundamentally the rejection of the Vedantist notion of an underlying self-identical substance. And the Buddha says, no, we're more like, there was an image many of you know of the torches. And the flame is passed from one torch to the next torch to the next torch. And the Buddha evidently suggested our self-identity through time is more like that, a series of events. Well, how does that make a difference? Well, it might not in itself, except that in process theology, this notion of prehension, that each event arises out of its prehensions of all prior events. So you see, this gets very much like the Buddhist notion of codependent origination, that every event arises out of all previous events. Whitehead had read some Buddhism, so he was probably influenced by this and also by quantum physics, which was just emerging. So this means that your relation to your own future, let's say your relation to yourself 20 years from now, you know you can live your, you can love your future self. You put aside money for your future self. If you can love your future self 20 years hence, why can't you love your spouse or your child or your neighbor who's right there next to you right now? So you see, this blocks that idea that somehow this is metaphysically impossible. Charles Hartshorn said this point is so important to him, that this event notion of individuality, that he would not give it up except for the most rigorous disproof of its truth. So I'm sure I have not conveyed the full importance of it here, but this is one of the central things about a process ethic, is it's based on a different metaphysic and therefore can support altruism and say against those who say, don't pretend to love others because that's just hypocrisy. This metaphysic gives you a basis for saying, maybe that's wrong. Maybe I can trust my own feelings, that I really do seem to trust others. And then maybe that'll help me generalize that beyond a narrow circle that I have natural sympathy for, and maybe think about loving those in other countries. Maybe that would make us less inclined to deprive them of food and medicine in Iraq and so on. But we don't want to get into politics, do we? Yes. It's almost like I've got these staged questions here that point number seven. Yeah. Yes, process theology supports an ecological ethic. It is an eco-theology. That term didn't exist in Whitehead's time, but he had already produced implicitly an eco-theology. Many dimensions of his thought support this. One is the doctrine of God. I've already suggested that that the process God influences all events and cares about them. The reverse side of the process God is God's reception to the world. In traditional theology, God was said to be immutable, impassible, self-sufficient. So what happened in the world literally did not affect God. So one could ask, well, what's the point of it all? Normally we would think the ultimate meaning of the world would be the meaning from the ultimate point of view. But from the point of view of the ultimate, according to that theology, the world means nothing. And this kind of view has disastrous consequences. Many of you would have read Jonathan Schell's Fate of the Earth. And a very important and wonderful book in many respects. And one that alerted many of us to the problem and got us working on some of the things we're working on now. But when he gets to the question, why would it make a difference if we destroyed the world prematurely? He has no answer. And yet the whole book is based on the premise that that would be the greatest catastrophe that could ever happen. And so he says, we need to take a risk. That was back in the Cold War. And he says, we need not to worry about that to the point of risking the very life of the planet, because there you've lost everything. But then when he, in those two or three pages where he says, well, what difference would it make? He finally has to say, none. Of course, he's presupposing an atheistic worldview. But given traditional theism, it comes out to the same thing. Whereas process theology says that everything that happens in the world does matter to God. So even if we fail in our efforts to save the planet from ecological destruction or more rapid ecological destruction through nuclear holocaust, the universe will never be as if we hadn't been. And the universe will never be as if we hadn't made the effort. That's such a paralyzing notion when people think through and say, well, I'm devoted to these causes, but then in moments of reflection you ask, well, what difference will it make in 100 years? What difference will it make in 1,000 years? What difference will it make in 1 million or 1 billion years? And if the answer is nothing, then it starts to seem like it's less important now, and maybe nothing matters now. So that's one dimension of it. The other dimension, as I already mentioned, is that we affirm intrinsic value all the way down. So we don't want to save the wilderness just because humans need the wilderness to retreat in. We do need that. But the wilderness also needs, is a place for wild animals to live. And they have their own unique form of value, which is, by hypothesis, valuable for God. So it is important to protect it in and for its own sake. Now, on the question of deep ecology, this term that Arne Naess introduced has been used in two different ways, at least. And the more generic meaning is any ecology is a deep ecology if it's not anthropocentric. So there are many anthropocentric ecologists, and many people who do the best work are anthropocentric. That is, they want to save the Earth and all of its species because they care about human beings and because we need this. And they do very good work. But maybe it's a more inclusive view, and also perhaps gives more ultimate sustaining motivation, if besides believing that, we also believe that all these other creatures have their own intrinsic value, just as human beings do, that's valuable to protect in its own right. And one way to reinforce that is to remind ourselves that all of these species were created by God, and they have their unique form of value to contribute to God. And so the richest world in terms of biological diversity is presumably the most valuable kind of world from the point of view of human beings. So when it comes to real questions of territory, as in Africa and many parts of Asia and other parts of the world today, where the humans are literally crowding the other species out. From an anthropocentric point of view, you might think, well, as long as those species like the elephant aren't really needed for human beings and gorillas and other big apes, oh, so what? Let them go. We need more room for human beings because we're God cares about. If we had this other view, maybe we would take more seriously stopping human population growth in order to leave room for the other species. Now, all deep ecologists agree that that the only motivation is not human. But within the deep ecology movement, then, some deep ecologists, or some who, in a sense, shanghaied that term, and here I mean mainly Bill Duvall and George Sessions, argued that you're not a deep ecologist unless you affirm an egalitarianism of value. And this seems to mean, in many of their statements anyway, that a human being and a mosquito would have equal intrinsic value. Now, Schweitzer theoretically affirmed that kind of view with his reverence for life. I mean, it was just reverence for all forms of life. He realized that in practice he couldn't live with it because he was a doctor and he was going to kill the microbes in order to save the elephant or save the human being. But theoretically, he affirmed that. You see, so it's not a view that many of us could live with to say literally all creatures have the same, all forms, all species have the same intrinsic value. Process thought gives a way of reconciling a hierarchical view, getting finally to your question. Are we at the apex? Presumably so. It does appear. This offends many people, but it does appear that human beings have more capacities to enjoy many more forms of value than other creatures, even as far as we can tell, the dolphin and the elephants and the chimpanzees and apes. But that view itself doesn't necessarily lead to anthropocentrism. It just leads to a hierarchy of value. Now, can one affirm a hierarchy of value, intrinsic value, and still be a deep ecologist? I would want to say yes, and I've tried to suggest a way, and John Cobb has written on this recently, and I haven't had a chance, John, to read that, so I don't know if you and I make the same move. But I have suggested there's a distinction between intrinsic value, which what Whiteheadians mean. What does an individual creature, its value in and for itself, is intrinsic value. And there I would say, generally, a moment of your experience is probably more intrinsically valuable than the a moment of a mosquito's existence. So if I see a mosquito around you that might have the West Nile virus, I'll probably kill the mosquito. But then there's inherent value, and that's what they seem to be talking about, Duval and Sessions. And this has to do with the total, you might say, value of something, considering its ecological value, its value within the ecosphere, as well as its intrinsic value. They seem to put in that everything except its value for human beings is inherent value. And there I would argue for an egalitarianism of inherent value. That is, the higher up the scale you go in terms of intrinsic value, generally the less ecological value a species has. So the beetles are much more important than we are. We have negative ecological value. Whereas the beetles and the worms would have very little intrinsic value, but those species, and that's what they're concerned about, the species, not the individuals, those species have absolutely essential ecological value. So that's a very long roundabout answer, but it's a very complex question. I hope I got around to something you were interested in that. Yeah. There was a question over here. Yes. Yeah. Don't put them on the same level. And that's why the charge that we believe in two gods is not true. God is the ultimate in the realm of actuality. So God is the ultimate actual being, the ultimate individual. Creativity is this formless stuff that all individuals, all actualities embody. Some of you know Aristotelian language. Aristotle distinguished things in terms of four generally translated causes, but factors would probably be more important, a better translation. Efficient causes, final causes, formal causes, and then the material cause is that underlying stuff that all things are made of. So creativity in Whitehead has that role. So rather than this passive matter that Aristotle was thinking of, it's energy, but energy enlarged to creativity, which involves value experience and self-determination. So that they're ultimate in terms of different questions. If you're asking one kind of question and you want to get to the ultimate, the end of that line of questioning, God is the answer. Another kind of questioning, the ultimate is creativity. Then there's a, you could even say there's a third ultimate, which is simply the world as a whole. And there is a third kind of religion that makes that the ultimate. So does that help? Yeah. And I was going to say in the lecture one thing I forgot to mention. It's been very, very difficult for Christians particularly, and I assume it's probably a similar problem for Muslims and Jews, to accept the idea that there could be two ultimates. And it seems like this goes back to this doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, which I see as the root of almost all evil theologically, that doctrine is the doctrine that everything, you know, that there was ultimately one ultimate origin, and then everything else is derivative from it. So I had a long ongoing debate with Houston Smith, and this became a book, which is called Primordial Truth and Postmodern Theology. Thank you. And so I take this kind of line in there, and Houston just comes back with, well, but what created that? I mean, he says it just seems intuitively self-evident that everything has to come from something. So if you've inherited the idea of creatio ex nihilo, it's a difficult notion, but many of us find it a very, very helpful notion. Did you want to come back with a further comment on that? Is that okay? Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, certainly that's a very difficult question. I take it that, you know, it's like in the Declaration, all men were created equal. Well, what did that mean? I mean, they knew that was not right, and there were those slaves there that were not... And there were those women there who were not going to be allowed to vote, and so on. I think it means something like you're to treat them as equals. This is it's a natural law declaration, that we take it as a moral law that everyone has equal rights, and therefore to be treated as if indeed they were equal. So certainly, you know, you can raise all sorts of difficult questions when you get down to extremely retarded human beings and then compare them with very bright chimpanzees. You would ask the question. Now, part of what process theology says is that that old line isn't as important as it used to be, because we're not saying that by definition, since you're human, you have these absolute rights, and if you're not human, you don't have any rights at all. So we're saying, let's give rights to all creatures according to their value. Now, having said that, I think just as a pragmatic move, it is pragmatically helpful to say, all human beings we are going to treat as if they are equal, even though, of course, because of brain and all sorts of problems, they're probably not. The other side of this is to recognize our ignorance. Sometimes there are intrinsic values there that we have no capacity to recognize. And so there's also the benefit of the doubt kind of argument. Oh, okay. So I don't know that process thought has anything distinctive to say on this in relation, where it does have some more on this issue. I think we would be very similar to many other modes of thought. Okay. Do you want to give him another, or does somebody else want to get in here? Okay, let's. Why not? Partly. Oh, he has a fundamental question, not a fundamentalist question. Why do I call this process theology? Well, because I work here for the Center for Process Studies, and this is propaganda. There's a historical answer and then a substantive answer to that, other than my flippant answers. The historical answer is, this is simply the name that caught on. Whitehead never called it that. He called it the philosophy of organism, or he would call it the organic philosophy. Charles Hartshorne called it, he focused on the theism, so he called it neoclassical theism. I think that was probably his dominant term, and neoclassical metaphysics. And I think it was John Cobb's teacher at University of Chicago, Bernard Loomer, who started using the term process philosophy. He wrote a very famous article, I think, called Process Philosophy and Christian Faith, something like that. And somehow that term caught on. Now, I defend the term as a good term because those who are here in my Whitehead class this semester, we're reading Science in the Modern World, and there are some very clear passages there where Whitehead uses the term in such a way that you could have thought he would have named it that himself, because he says emphatically, the reality is the process. Now, what did he mean by the process? Some people, when I used, at the beginning I said there's a broad meaning of the term and then a more precise, narrow meaning. In the broad meaning, and there are some books that talk about philosophies of process, any philosophy that says the ultimate reality is change, that all things flow, Heraclitus then becomes the original process philosopher who said you can't step in the same river twice. Whitehead has a much more precise meaning of process and this notion of substances. So whereas Descartes thought that physical substances were bits of extended matter, that all they had geometrical properties and they endured through time and they had no experience, there was nothing going on inside. They were just dead brute matter. So quite often when the word substance is used, it has that kind of connotation. So it's why we generally don't talk about actual substances or something. Whitehead says the actual entities are actual occasions, and that means they're momentary events. They happen. And so an occasion at the level of an electron might be a billionth of a second. At our level, maybe Whitehead suggested in one sort of offhand comment, maybe there are 12 per second, so that a human actual occasion would be a 12th of a second. What's going on in there is this, as I mentioned earlier, each occasion begins by prehending previous occasions, but then it makes a self-determining response, and then a part of its self-determination is how it intends to influence the future. So the actual entity itself is a process of becoming. And so Whitehead used the term concrescence for that process. It's the process of becoming concrete. And then once it's concrete, It's a cause, an efficient cause, upon future occasions that gets their concrescence coming, started, and then they have their process of becoming, and the process just keeps going. So Whitehead then, and I'll finish up on this point, distinguishes between two kinds of process. So there is this internal process that occurs within an occasion, and then there's the external process, the transition from occasion to occasion. He calls that transition. So what you have is a perpetual oscillation then between two kinds of causation. And this has been one of the, this is the most philosophical point I think I made today, most technical point. One of the major problems of modern philosophy is how to reconcile efficient causation, which people normally have thought of as kind of mechanistic causation, one billiard ball hitting another, and final causation, or self-determination. Final causation means causation headed towards a finis, towards a goal. And Whitehead says one of the major tasks of philosophy is to show how final and efficient causation are related to each other, because it has been an extreme mystery for modern thought. You have John Searle up at University of California, Berkeley, one of the leading philosophers in the country. And he says in his little book, Mind, Brains, and Science, science teaches us that there is no room for freedom in the world, because science teaches us that everything that happens, happens because of the efficient causation of the past and those efficient causes at the lowest level of nature. So the subatomic particles that produce everything up, and this is what's called reductionism. You can reduce all higher level entities, processes to what was going on at the lowest level. But at the same time, Searle says, as a human being, I cannot help presupposing that I'm free. I make decisions. And by freedom, I meant I did that, I could have done something else. And I hold myself, I hold my children, I hold my colleagues responsible for the decisions. Now, how do I reconcile that, what I live with in practice, with my worldview? I don't. I just, you know, so it's a mystery. And Whitehead gives you a way then of showing that there's this. So for me, this is the very heart of what process philosophy is, that there's this perpetual oscillation between efficient causation and final causation. So you have the final causation, the self-determination, and then that becomes a concrete event, which becomes an efficient cause on the future events. They exercise their final causation, and the process keeps going. Whitehead used the term perpetual perishing for this process. Well, that's proved to be a most misleading term. And if I had been around while he was still writing, the major suggestion I would have made was change it to perpetual oscillation. And that'll make it much more clarity as to what process philosophy and therefore what process theology are. And then it applies to God too. By hypothesis, this same sort of process applies in God. Now, this gets more controversial here in Claremont because not everybody agrees that both of those processes go on in God. But I'm giving you my belly laugh. So, I mean my theology. And so in my theology, these twofold, these perpetual oscillation goes on in God too. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and partly it can be a terminological problem because we use the word consciousness in different ways. So Whitehead used consciousness for a very high level form of experience. So experience goes all the way down, but consciousness is a very rare form of experience. He used it for, he talks about the affirmation-negation contrast. When you can look at something and say, it is this, not that. This is yellow, not red. You're conscious of it. But a lower creature might respond to the yellow without being conscious that it was yellow. So you can have experience without consciousness. Now, but that still leaves the question, can we imagine or can we conceive that experience goes all the way down? Surely it's how can there be self-determination going all the way down? Surely this would be hard for us to imagine. It would, even if we distinguish between imagine and conceive, it's even difficult for us to conceive. Thomas Nagel, who's one of the ones who is very honest about the mind-body problem, has a famous essay called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And he's discussing the fact that bats evidently have a system of vision that's completely different than ours. At least one theory is that through the sound, they turn the sound into visual images, and that's how they're able to be so precise getting those little bugs. But in any case, the bat's existence is something we can't conceive. We cannot imagine what it's like to be a bat. But then he asked the question, can we imagine that it's like something to be a bat? Well, yeah. We figure that the bat has some experience. So if we saw a kid being cruel to a bat, we would say, quit doing that. You're making the bat suffer. It's like something to be a bat, whereas it's not like something, by hypothesis, to be, let's say, a rock. Now, this gets into another question, difference between individuals and aggregates. The question then is, is there some point where you could draw a line and say, below that line, I don't think it's like anything to be those things. Now, this distinction I was making, we're talking about genuine individuals. So I would say a molecule would be a genuine individual, a rock wouldn't be. So in the line of genuine individuals, so we go down through mammals and birds and so on, and you're probably with me there. And then at some point, like one philosopher says, cockroaches. As I draw the line, I can't imagine that they have any experience and any freedom. I think he just wanted an excuse to crush every cockroach he could. Others draw the line further down. But wherever you draw the line, you've got a problem. First of all, you've got a conceptual problem. How could something with experience and final causation arise out of something purely mechanical in a non-supernatural? See, Descartes had his supernaturalistic God, and when anybody asked a question, well, how do these things relate, he could just say, God does it. And, I mean, a whole school of thought was built on this, the occasionalists, Malebranche and Gulenks. They said, on the occasion, since mind and body cannot influence each other, I put my hand on the stove. It's burning. But the body can't influence the mind, so I don't know it's burning, so my hand's going to burn it. So on the occasion of by putting hand there, God makes my mind hurt. And so I look down and say, oh my God, my hand is burning. So I decide, I think I'll move my hand. But then I can't, because the mind can't influence the body, because it's completely different. So on the occasion of my deciding to move my hand, God obliges, and after a minute or two, my hand is saved. So, this is how serious this problem was taken. So it was only in the supernaturalistic context that dualism made sense. And so once supernaturalism went and people couldn't appeal to this deus ex machina, then that's what led us to materialism. And then you have a very bright philosopher of religion at Oxford who is, again, arguing for supernaturalism on the basis of dualism. He says, materialism doesn't work. Clearly there's a mind that's different from the body. But they couldn't possibly interact naturally. Therefore, there's a God who makes them interact. So within a naturalistic framework, the idea of an evolutionary continuum is very difficult. So I say that's the conceptual problem. The empirical problem is when you look at things through a microscope, either literally or metaphorically, they seem very different. And so one bit of evidence that I cite a lot here has to do with bacteria. There's a fellow named Donald Koshland at UC Berkeley. He's one of the leading biologists in the country, editor of one of the leading journals. And he and his colleagues have done experiments with bacteria. This is the lowest form of life. Now, I know some of you have your own candidates for the look, but we're not getting into politics. And so this is the lowest form of life. That's as far as you can, you know, the debatable if viruses alive. But so it's extremely simple compared with more complex forms of life. And yet, he says, there is now empirical evidence that bacteria make decisions on the basis of memory. That you put something in their environment that they've never experienced before that's unpleasant, they will approach it. And then when it gets unpleasant, they go away. Next time you inject that, they move away right away. So they seem to have spontaneity, make decisions on the basis of memory. So you seem to have spontaneity and experience. Well, then when you go down to viruses, they have very remarkable properties in the right environment. And then go all the way down. So anywhere where you suggest to draw a line, there's always going to be an objection to it. And this is one of the things that modern science, or one might say postmodern science, has helped us philosophically, because we have empirical evidence that the people in the 17th century didn't have. And yet, many philosophers and theologians still try to live with the basic worldview they got from the 17th century. Yes? What a superb question. How is prehension different from memory? Gosh, you must be one of those bright students from UC Riverside. Is that possible? It's 6 o'clock, so this will have to be the last answer. I'm just warning people because it's a kind of complex answer. But Hartshorne has argued, I think rightly, that one of the great benefits of this view, this general pan-experientialist view of reality, is that it has the virtue of simplification that in the sciences we usually take to be a sign of truth. That is, if you can show that two kinds of energy are really the same, that's a great breakthrough. And people who make such discoveries get Nobel Prizes and so on. So to show that things that are apparently very different are really down deep the same is generally considered, that kind of simplicity is usually taken as a sign of genius on the part of the discoverer and of truth. Hartshorne points out that Whitehead's theory of prehension actually unifies 9 different phenomena that at first glance seem to be completely different, such as perception, memory, time, space, substance, causality, and 3 more. Well, I said such as. So let's take the 2 that you ask about. Perception we usually take to be perceiving something other than ourselves. Memory, given the assumption that we're one self-enduring substance enduring through time, we think of as self-perception. So we think, well, memory is one thing, perception is another thing. But if this event theory is right, then in remembering a previous moment, you're remembering, you're prehending a previous actual occasion, a previous occasion of experience. And so the fact that it was what you call your own isn't quite so important. So the difference between perceiving your own past and perceiving something else is relativized. And so actually, there are two forms of the same thing. The difference only being whether the one is one that you identify with and you say, that was me, because you prehend it more fully, prehend it from within, and the other you say, I'm perceiving something other than me. So the simplifying notion here is that prehension is always of the past. It's never of the contemporary, exact contemporary present. Normally, perception had been thought of, you know, memory is, that's another distinction. Memory is of the past, perception is of the present. But we all know, when you see the sun, you're seeing something that happened 8 minutes ago. And even, you know, I'm looking at this podium, it doesn't take a whole lot of time, since light moves right along, it doesn't take a whole lot of time, but it does take time for the light to get, the photons to get from the podium to my eye, and then for the synapses to go up the optic nerve. So there's a split second there. So whatever you perceive, you're perceiving the past. And so that's also true of memory. So there are two different names for some very similar things. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'm enjoying this, and I could stay here all night, but I know you need to go. So goodbye.